Yay.
So much enthusiasm.
Yes.
As per usual, as the kids say, they say usual because they abbreviate things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the kids got to do what they have to do. You know, you got to do you. So you do you.
We're 3 seconds into the show and you're already trolling me.
Is this a show yet?
I think it is.
Oh, okay. Well, that's disappointing then.
It's too bad Tom Hardy didn't say, you got to do you when he was talking to,
well, he might have, and we just didn't hear what he said. Zing. Do you want to get right into the movie, or did you want to have some playful banter first before we scare everyone away who hasn't seen it?
Let's have precisely 5 minutes of playful banter,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll move on to the actual meat of the whole thing. A podcast appetizer, if you will.
The horse meat.
I didn't actually eat the horse.
No, but he probably thought they smelled bad on the outside.
Yeah, I had that thought too. So you went and saw the movie with one of our listeners. You broke the fifth wall?
I don't know. I maintained my personal space in that we didn't shake hands. So it was fine. I was protected. Him. Yeah.
You had your protective layer of the hoodie so you could just stuff your hands in your pockets and avoid all that?
Yeah, well, listener Rye had moved to this side of town, and that was like several months ago, and we had exchanged hey, maybe some coffee sometime. So we actually had that, and then it was like, oh, I have to go see this movie later. And then he's like, yeah, well, I haven't seen it yet. And I was like, oh, shoot. We can go...
This is awkward.
Yeah, I was like, we could go see it. And he's like, yeah, well, I mean, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I don't want to ruin your night. And he's like, nope, let's go. And I was like, ah, fine. Rye. Anyway, it was fun seeing the movie with Rye.
You both wore your defocus t-shirts.
Yeah,
you
that
wore
was
blue, and he had the gray.
That was a very unfortunate accident, actually. I thought it would be funny if I showed up wearing one of them. And then he also thought it would be funny if he showed up wearing one of them. But together... not as funny. So
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, I just zipped up my hoodie. It was a little embarrassing.
He told me that you had both shown up to the coffee in the shirts, and I told him that if you were both still wearing it when you went to see the movie later, that he had to get a photo. And because I had that prep time, I put mine on as well, so I could appropriately reply with the photo.
Yeah, I didn't really think that was just a coincidence that you had one on as well.
Yeah, no. I didn't wear it to see the movie today. I wore it's a teal blue shirt, but it's an R2-D2 shirt.
Ah.
It's pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
Got it at Kohl's.
Does it come with a C-3PO shirt?
No.
Oh. Jetpack, oil, any of that stuff going on?
No, it's just this really cool 80s looking circle design thing with R2-D2 in it.
Oh. Well. Okay, I guess. If you want to advertise for some brand, I suppose that's fine.
Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous.
Remember how you used to say that space movies were not that interesting to you and that you don't really like Star Wars and stuff? And then here you are, emblazoned with your R2-D2.
Mm-hmm. Have I ever given you my opinion on Westerns?
Yes, because we've talked about Westerns before. And I have also given you my opinion on Westerns.
Which Westerns did we talk about?
When we talked about Django Unchained.
I guess it's kind of a Western.
It's kind of, sort of. And this is, I don't know if you want to get all technical and be like a Northwest Frontier Territory whatever thing, but somewhere in the Dakotas / Wyoming, Montana, Argentina area, this is, and sometimes Alberta, Canada, this is... movie is basically a Western, and it's one of those, I don't know, revenge Westerns. So it's a category, it's a genre, it's well trod, I would say, at this point. I just watched True Grit again tonight, just to have something to compare and contrast in my head.
It's got the dude in it.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about of course, as you said, the dude, the 2010 version, which is actually a remake of the John Wayne one. So
his name's Marion,
mm-hmm.
not John.
Yep.
Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, the True Grit was pretty good when it came out. I remember enjoying it. It's kind of bleak, if I recall, but it's... did you find the dude as unintelligible as Tom Hardy in this movie?
He is mumbly. It doesn't help that Matt Damon also has a speech impairment at a certain point in the film, and that everyone else kind of has like a really old fashioned way of talking. But somehow I found that more intelligible and easier to follow than, let's say, another movie that was a Western that exists that maybe we're talking about today. So, yeah, I don't know.
So The Revenant.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie.
Yeah.
A lot of people are fans.
It's done really well for itself. It's not across the board, you know, critical acclaim, but nearly, very nearly. It seems since it was announced and since press started circulating while they were making it, that it was predestined to be up for awards.
And it's got an 8.3 on the IMDb. I don't know what that means. And it's got a 76 Metascore, which I also don't know what that means, but sure.
Yeah, it's higher than zero. So people like it. And as we've talked about several times in previous episodes, and especially last year's episode on Birdman, which is a film that you like, and I just got very angry.
That's one way to put it.
I hate that movie. This particular director makes choices that I just sort of rub me the wrong way personally. And that is often reflected in the work that he does, as well as outside of the work when he's doing the press for his work. So the two things are working against him. And I try to judge this fairly when I was sitting there to watch this this time around. And I have to say that while I don't like the film, I like it more than Birdman. I didn't hate it with every fiber of my being. There's that. It's an improvement, I suppose.
Yeah, that's high praise right there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we've gone over it probably in too many episodes about how his off-screen presence, Mr. Iñárritu, doesn't do his films any favors, and he's kind of insulting to an industry that you work in and I sort of tangentially work in. But skipping past that for the moment, does this movie do a lot of the same things that drove you mad in Birdman?
It's different. It has the same sort of, we have a style or a thing and we want to really focus on that, and we're just going to do it for 2.5 hours. And you are either someone who's going to be on board with the thing they're hammering on, or you're not. This also has another problem in that since Iñárritu has a writing credit on this and on Birdman, they both are films where women, shall we say, not front and center, and that when we do see them, they are often in this film, they are often victims and bad things are happening. So it's not. I would like to see him challenge himself in the future by like having believable female characters that are not just there to suffer for someone else, and that it's not just about like one man's important role in the world to fix something or to do that one perfect thing or whatever it is. I find that doesn't really like super appeal to me, even though, you know, I'm, you know, a white guy, so theoretically both of his movies should appeal to me. but he's just managed to focus very much on this one person's perseverance and against all odds mentality of pushing forwards that I just sort of find eye rolling. It's weird because it's like you're going for realism, but then you have like this intense focus on this character.
So the going for realism thing, is that what you mean with like the,
Says he's going for realism. I don't find this realistic at all.
The actual action, or you mean like the long takes and the wide angle up in everyone's face and that kind of stuff?
Well, they've talked about how they wanted it to be visceral and like you're there. I didn't feel like I was there.
I didn't feel that way either. Yeah. You know, this whole, you know, they've mentioned the claustrophobia and, you know, getting really close to things and trying to give that feeling with this up in people's face, wide angle stuff that they did. Basically, the entire movie is like 3 inches from DiCaprio's face with a wide angle lens. But I didn't actually find that that helped much. I mean, it did add some interesting depth to the staging that they could do with the various actors. You know, you could have people very close and people who looked like they were far away in sort of traditional blocking, but they weren't actually all that far away. It was just a matter of where the camera was and what it emphasized. But I didn't actually feel like it was personal or realistic in a way that they were striving for. They just kept getting closer and closer to somebody's face. And it's like, I see what you're doing. Doesn't really help your point that much, but there's so many different directions to come at this movie, because there are some things about this movie that are interesting and unique, and there's some gorgeous imagery in it. But as a movie, there's a lot of problems with it. But I think a lot of it has been overshadowed with the complexity of what they did. There's a lot of technical filmmaking in here. And then, you know, of course, all of the other things we've talked about with the filmmakers themselves being giant tools while they're being interviewed.
Yeah. Let's I guess focus on that first, since we've danced around it a couple of points where we're trying to enter this conversation. The press for this, no matter what your feelings on this are, you will have touched on something somewhere, some commercial, some poster, some interview, some thing, some video clip, whatever it is. They are out in full force lobbying for this thing. And it is about how hard it was to make, how grueling it was to make, how difficult it was for Leonardo DiCaprio as an actor to be able to do these performances under these conditions. That is a heavy component to this. And depending on how much you are exposed to that going into the film, it might color your expectations or opinion of the film that you're seeing, because I find that sort of media press lobbying for these, basically lobbying for awards for this, I find that sort of irritating, because it's sort of like, hey, everyone, come check out my homework assignment that I did. I did such a good job on my homework assignment. It's like, slow down. Everybody had a homework assignment. Calm yourself. It's like, no, you don't understand. I did my homework assignment out there in the woods. It's like, okay, but you didn't have to like do that literally, but it's great that you did. I'm sure it'll come across in the work that you did. No, I just want to make sure you know, everyone, just gather around. I want to talk some more about it. And it's like, oh God, please just stop it. Like, yeah.
You know, you remember way back yonder when Joss Whedon made that first Avengers movie? You remember that one?
I do.
You remember that one scene where he went like, look at me, I'm Joss Whedon. And he did that one shot that went from every single person fighting in that end battle back and forth to all the different characters, so we could just sort of see them all of the chaos happening at one time.
Yeah, I know, because you hate that shot, and they did the same thing at the beginning of the second one, and you hated that too.
Right. This movie is 2.5 hours of that same thing, of the director going, look at me, look what I can do. And it's in terms of the difficulty in making, like, yeah, there's a lot of technical filmmaking, because a lot of that stuff requires planning and knowing exactly what you're going to do, and you've got a lot of you've got to have the right people and equipment, and you've got to spend the time to get the light right and the blocking right and the timing and everything right. But I'm watching this and I see what they're doing, and I go, okay, I know you can do that. And then they just keep doing it over and over and over again. It's like, good Lord, guys, I get it. You're good at filmmaking. I understand that you have a command over the technical aspects of this, and the people who did the copious amounts of post work, for which I'm sure there is way more than even people like me and you could anticipate. Just the same thing with Birdman, because, you know, remember we talked about in Birdman where if it looked like there was probably a cut, there was probably a cut that something got stitched together. And I think the same thing is here, as noted by the fact that there are, did I count 9 or 10 visual effects houses in the credits in this one?
I didn't count the number of them. It was, I think, ILM and Image Engine and
MPC was in there. There were 9 visual effects studios in a row at the end there, but Legacy was for some reason further up in the credits away from them. So I think it was 10. But there's so much work in this, and then you know, I get lost in my, you know, estimation of the film, because there's some beautiful stuff. And for some of the stuff I can see, like, okay, they just went from a techno crane shot to a handheld shot there. And it's sort of seamless in the way they did this pan around and nobody will notice. But I noticed, because it's very clear that the movement of the camera changed here, and most people won't know that. And that there's a lot of work in there to make that look right. But then all of the other things about character and storytelling and just emotion, they're criminally abused and just underutilized in this movie. Like they're almost non-existent in a lot of aspects.
Okay. Well, I think we went really far from talking about.
Yeah. Sorry.
The marketing part of this. I like how you said we were going to focus on one thing to get in, and then I talked about that one thing. I tried really hard, and then I don't know what else we can say about it.
Yeah, I mean, you covered it all. They're lobbying really hard because this was a hard movie to make, and the reason it's hard is because to get something this polished and this well executed in these sorts of conditions is not an easy task. I mean, even if you have the best people, the elements are just going to be against you, and you do what you got to do from time to time to just, you got to throw stuff out and start over again, I guess. And you know, there's these, that weird article you sent where they were talking about improv-ing things. Like, very little of this seems to have been actually improv, except like the little close-up of like ants and stuff on the ground. But
no, but they said that was an example of sometimes maybe that would happen, but mostly it is grueling rehearsal work for several hours before they actually film a few takes with the correct lighting conditions, because they were filming at a certain time of day for every single one of these, so they would sit right in, because it is, unfortunately, they kept harping on in the press a natural light that just means like they didn't bring in any light sources and to do anything, but they're outside, so it's not that horribly unexpected for most of the stuff. Although, you know, some bounce cards or whatever, I don't know if they're counting what they might be counting for that sort of thing. But in the end, it's still adjusted. It's still shot over several days in several different locations. There's still background enhancements and stuff. So it's like, okay, fine, whatever. But you know, you graded one shot up and one shot down because it was a little cloudier one day, or you know, you flipped one shot and now the shadow's on the wrong side or whatever. But it's not as big of a thing as they were talking about. It's not as novel. I should say.
The natural light thing is kind of ridiculous because, I mean, I take one of the points that, like, sure, you can't really compete with the sun because you're outside, and what are you going to do to actually light these people? But like, you don't get an extra prize for not using lights. I mean, I think one of the comments in that interview with the DP basically sounded like he was saying, like, well, there wouldn't have been, you know, there's no place for light because they're outside and it should feel like there's no light out there. It's like, well, your whole job as a cinematographer is to light stuff so it doesn't look like it's lit. You're supposed to light stuff so it looks like a movie. But sure, whatever. I mean, if you want to say no lights or just make it look like there was no lights, but yeah, there's, you've got bounce off the snow, you've got bounce from the sun, you can do whatever you want with it. But like, that, you don't get points for saying we didn't bring lights out there. That just means like you were making it arbitrarily slightly more difficult on yourself. Like, I mean, when we did our last thing, and not to even remotely compare the conditions, but it was a snowy thing we shot with an Alexa outdoors. Like, we didn't
bring... Was it the Alexa 65?
No, because there's only like three of those, and I don't think they would have given me one. It was the Alexa Mini. But like, you know, for the bright daytime stuff, we didn't need lights, for one, because the guy was far enough away that, you know, wouldn't have made a difference. But like, in shadow, yeah, you bust out a light, you can use it for stuff, but you know, you get a lot of stuff with the snow. Like, I don't know. That's one of the more annoying things. The natural light thing is kind of insane, because it doesn't make a difference. But again, this is their marketing. We went out there, like, sure, props for going out there and having Leo crawl around in the snow and dirt, like half naked at times, because that would have been arduous and unpleasant and something only a very committed actor would have been in the mood to do. But like, okay, I mean, you read the script, that's what he signed up to do. So sure, it's difficult, but that's the task at hand.
But okay, well, in terms of the marketing, let's talk about the lobbying for the acting, basically. So I don't know if you noticed this, but a lot of people were talking about Leo getting an acting award for this. And it is.
Yeah, I noticed.
Yeah. And, you know, he got the Golden Globe for it. I after having seen the film, I came away with the trying to process, like, how much of what I saw was acting versus athletics, I guess, is like I felt like a lot of the stuff he was doing was a physically difficult performance. But was I necessarily, did his character performance transport me anywhere? Did I believe in this guy, this glass fellow? And I would have to say that I didn't find it really that intimate or accessible a performance, because most of the time he's not talking. He's not.
Yeah, there's a very large portion of this movie where he's doing basically nothing except pretending to have a fever and kind of drooling on a like wooden bed thing.
Yeah, he's wheezing and grunting and wheezing some more and grunting some more and groaning. And then trying to talk with wheezy noises, and like it goes on for a really long time. And so at the end of the day, what do I know about his character? It's that he loves his family and he'll protect them to the best of his ability. And if anything bad happens to them, he will get vengeance upon the person who did the bad thing.
Yeah, we're meant to sort of assemble his character backstory from those odd sort of flashbacky kind of things that happened at the beginning, and then the several fever dreams he has throughout the movie, where you sort of see him looking at the same stuff over and over again, and the super not subtle dialogue that is asked of him several times, where they say, "Did you really kill an officer?" It's like. Basically, his character, he has a Native American son. Some American soldiers tried to come in and kill basically everyone, and someone tried to kill his son, and he killed them. And then he moved out into the wilderness and became sort of a guy who knows the land, and he's a tracker for these the pelt farmers or whatever. But yeah. There's not much more to his character. We don't know anything more to it other than he claims to love and want to defend his son, although there's like zero actual family chemistry between them. They could have been brothers. They could have been, I don't know, cousins or something. It didn't really make a difference to us.
Yeah.
Could have been just really good friends.
Yeah. So, you know, not to veer off into any of those particular things, although I do think we have more to say on all of these points in the movie. I will, just to sum up the sort of acting lobbying and stuff that's going on, is just that I, after having seen the film and after all the things that you and I have described, I don't come away from this going, wow, what an amazing acting performance. I think it was an endurance challenge, but it was a physical endurance challenge. And I'm not sure how I weight that against like a juicy, meaty role of something that a character is coming alive on screen. It didn't feel as accessible even as some of the other, or as interesting as some of the other people that were maybe even in the same film with him, even though they have less screen time. Like Tom Hardy, nobody's really like lobbying for Tom Hardy or anything like that. But I thought that as a sociopath, he did a very decent job. Most of the time you can't understand what he's saying, but he has one really good scene where he's intimidating the other guy and staring right into his face and the whole squirrel thing, God. And it's just like, you know, that is acting there. I'll give him that. Like, and I'm not like a super huge Tom Hardy fan, but then I sit here and I'm like, well, so when did Leo have that like moment of just coming alive on screen? And I'm just like, I don't know.
Now he was able to portray a very large and deep amount of pain at various instances, but that's all he does. He does it well, but he does it over and over and over again. And after a while, that level of intensity just kind of loses its effect on the audience, because it's like, okay, we understand that like basically everything that happens to you is the worst possible thing that could possibly happen at this moment, and you're going to have to fight your way through it. But you know, you've just got this drive inside you that's going to make you persevere through all of this pain. But like you say, there weren't really any moments for him to be a character and actually act aside from trying to act like he's in pain or in danger. You know, his life is in danger, or he's got to flee, he's got to survive, he's got to do this and that or whatever. But it's all pretty much in the same direction of grunting and spitting and crawling on the ground, and you know,
you forgot gritting his teeth and breathing through his teeth.
Gritting his teeth. There's some teary eyes. There's some mm-hmm. little bit of begging. But yeah, he's not
rictus of pain.
Wasn't for his kid, I would find it almost impossible to care about his character. Because I mean, so he gets attacked by a bear, but that's one of those things in this particular environment that I just sort of take as just one of the dangers of the land, and it's the things you got to deal with, and it happens to people, and it's a bummer, but like that doesn't engender a lot of sort of empathy just on its face that you got attacked by a bear and you didn't die right away, but you know we're meant to care about him because he was betrayed by Tom Hardy, and he fights his way back for his revenge, but like okay sure that's. That's 2.5 hours?
Yep. Apparently. I think we've talked about the marketing and how that might have potentially soured at least me on being super receptive, even though I've tried to be as objective as humanly possible. I don't know if that's necessarily going to be the case. And I know that many other people have seen this and many other people like it and will disagree with me. But it definitely is something to consider. Now, let's talk about the opening of this with the sort of dissolve-y, flashback-y, like laying in bed, waking up, not sure what's happening thing. And then we're at the fur camp.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't initially entirely sure what was happening in these scenes at the start. It was very, I know it was intentionally dreamlike, but for the start of the film, I didn't have enough concrete facts by the time we started having people shoot one another that I wasn't entirely sure what the relationship of everyone was to everyone else. So like when the chief from the other, we don't even know it's another tribe. We just have the Cree that they're referred to here. I think it's Akara. They're different from the life that Leonardo DiCaprio had with his wife and his son. But we don't necessarily understand this dynamic initially. So we're just sort of thrown into it from that dream with the wife and the son to the elk hunting where they shoot the CG elf that's off to the side of the screen. And then they say elk or elf.
I think you said elf, but I understood what you meant.
Well,
a CG elf, sure.
Yeah, CG elf.
They're hunting Will Ferrell for his pelt.
Yeah, the library elf. They're shooting an elk off to the side. And that is that means they're away from the camp when they're invaded and attacked. And then the chief from the tribe talks about his daughter, looking for his daughter from there. And so then initially at the beginning of the movie, I'm just like, wait, was Leonardo DiCaprio's apparent wife the daughter that he's looking for? It was like, why don't they just go talk to the? And I was like, wait, is this one of those things where it's supposed to be purposefully confusing or is it just not explained? Did I miss something? It was sort of like I don't think that was super clear. Later on in the film, I pieced together what was going on, but I thought the beginning was somewhat disorganized and did not clearly convey like what the motivations of these characters were, especially considering the scope of the battle that unfolds with tomahawks flying and arrows and bullets being fired and the cameras just swirling all around through it. It just felt like really disconnected. And there are parts where they just remove the dialogue audio of characters screaming or talking and just replace it with like bass sounds and with just nature sounds and noises. And you're just like, I don't understand what you guys are doing. But that's a thing.
Mm. Yeah. I understand what you're saying about not really understanding the dynamics of the characters right off out of the gate there. I guess I wasn't trying to assemble the narrative that quickly, because I mean, from that first shot where they're stalking the elk through the river there, where it spends, I don't know, 45, 60 seconds looking straight down at the water before it even bothers to tilt up to see the actors. I kind of knew we were in store for a slow burn of a movie. And I just kind of put my head back against the chair and said, all right, let's enjoy the ride as we go, because it's just going to be this kind of thing for a while. And, I mean, sure enough, that was it. But the attack, they're there doing a job, and then they get attacked. And then I guess the natives, whichever ones these ones are going to be, you know, take the pelts to go trade with the French, because he literally says, we'll go trade them to the French for guns and horses, which the dialogue in this movie, let me be clear, is not good. It's actually quite bad in many instances. Tom Hardy's little speech there that you were talking about, where the guy seeing God in squirrel in the squirrel was actually kind of well written, but a lot of the things that sort of explain what's actually happening in the movie are they couldn't be more blunt and to the point.
I see what you're saying about like you're along for the ride, but I try to put together the puzzle as it's, you know, as I'm getting puzzle pieces, and so when I'm getting puzzle pieces and it's not really clear what kind of a puzzle I have yet. I probably could slow down, but it still was sort of frustrating. And then we, in terms of the battle, I also found that disorienting, because we're not cutting from certain vantage points, to establish some sort of geography, like a line of action. Like they're on this side, this is on that side. They're surrounded, but this is where the bulk of the bad people are that are shooting at them. This is where their boat is. I didn't even know they had a boat until they were screaming about going to the boat. So that was interesting. But the decision to go with just like one long take through many parts of this, where we're just weaving through trees, I couldn't figure out like what the direction of things were. And so that could be there to make us feel like there is chaos that we're embroiled in, but because we're not cutting, it's not like frantic, hurried action. It's sort of slow and winding. It's sort of hard to describe, but it kind of disconnects me as we're like floating through a battle. It feels like I'm in like a video game and there's a battle occurring and I'm waiting to spawn. And so I can just like wander through whatever's happening. It's very, very strange.
Yeah. This idea of just sort of like wandering through the scene to explore what's going on over there and explore what's going on over here. I think that could be an interesting way to tell a certain kind of story, I'm not sure that it needed to be the way they told this entire story.
No. And it just goes on the whole entire time. That's what I was alluding to earlier when I was talking about like having a style and like trying to stick with it is really the whole thing. Just like what they did with Birdman. They were like, yeah, we're just going to do one continuous thing.
See, I felt like it was way more like appropriate in Birdman though, than it was here, because it was sort of, you know, there was actually an established timeline for the, you know, the plays or whatever was going on there with the rehearsals and then the actual thing. Here it was just sort of like, I don't know if he just like doesn't know another way to make the movie. Like, every scene is going to open up on like a close up, beautiful nature shot of something. And then we're going to slowly meander over here to a character who's going to do a thing over here, and then we're going to slowly meander over to this character and get really close to their face and see different stuff from their vantage point. And then we'll move in closer for this extra emotional moment. And then we'll pull away here. It's like, okay, I get it. Like, you know, you're basically showing us where all of your different camera angles would be for this scene. You're just like not cutting between them for some reason. You're just, you feel like we need to literally walk from camera position 1, 2, 3, and 4.
It really distracts me in many of these instances, because I find that it you just feel like you're floating outside of what's happening. So while we're all up in their grill, we are in their grill and then far away and then in their grill and then over around a tree and stuff. And so it's not the space is fluctuating. And so you're not intimately involved with what's happening. At least is how I feel when I see it. I know that the whole reason they did this was that you would feel like you were there, according to what the cinematographer has said was his stated goal, that you would feel immersed in it. I just didn't feel immersed. I felt very distant from it, actually, because I was paying attention to what the camera's doing, rather than, you know, you just cut and have another angle and they deliver their dialogue, and you cut and have another angle and they deliver their dialogue. And some of that might be we just expect a certain film language for describing these sorts of scenes, and that this is not the same sort of language we would expect. To a degree, I could agree with that, except that, you know, it's sort of like deciding that you're just going to stick it out all by yourself and do your own thing might introduce an extra level of difficulty. And I feel like it does introduce an extra level of difficulty, and it didn't connect for me.
Yeah, I mean, intimacy aside, it's clear that they wanted to try something different, and they succeeded in whatever it was that they had set out to do, you know, technically and in terms of just, you know, filmmaking. But this particular style is not something that particularly appeals to me. It felt to bring back one of the things we've talked about with other directors. It felt overtly self-indulgent and just, you know, kind of unnecessary.
Yeah. And there's the decision to have things on the lens
from time to time. Yes.
It's mostly
in fights and during, and when they're in the water.
Yeah. Well, and his foggy breath stuff.
Oh yeah. That was a really odd choice. I kind of feel like that was one of those improv moments where it was just like, well, we're so close to his face. And based on the fact that this is like one shot where we're not actually looking up at him, he's actually below us, his breath fogged the lens, and we're going to kind of use that as an element. It's like, really? That's that one particular instance is where in the entire movie, yeah, you can talk about like splatter on the lens or something, but that one instance went like, whoa, this is a camera in his face.
Yeah. And see, I don't necessarily object to that happening at all. Like, you know, maybe, you know, some stuff would land on the lens, whatever. It just didn't feel like if your goal is to make me involved in what's happening, then you're putting a screen between me and the action when you do that, because then I have something that I have things that are sticking to a point in screen space. And maybe that's because, you know, I've worked on things where we need to consider this sort of layering, but I just see that layer, that extra film between me and what's happening that bothers me. It might not bother other people, but it was something that I noticed because I have to pay attention to that sort of thing in my work life. So maybe that has just ruined me as a human being, but it is vexing when things are constantly on the lens and they don't go away because we don't cut. So it stays there. And then you're looking at that speck of blood or that snow or that water droplet or the breath accumulating, or you're looking at the lens flare that just lingers for forever. And there's one shot where Leonardo DiCaprio is up on a ridge later in the movie, and there's a huge lens element flare thing going on. And it's a perfectly still shot, but the lens element is moving up and down and side to side and expanding and contracting. So obviously it was post stabilized for.
I must have missed that. Which shot was that?
Oh, I don't. It wasn't like horribly egregiously bad, but we're lingering on the shot so long that I'm just watching the lens elements fluctuate. He's like up on some snowy ridge looking down, and there's just the sun off on the horizon, and it's just a little speck, and there's all the little green polygons from the, well, they're not polygons, but you know what I mean, lens flare elements all hanging out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the blood elements like got splashed with water and washed away and stuff, but yeah, for the most part, when they did get kicked up on the lens, they were rather noticeable. I mean, I think they tried to use some of it judiciously, like during the fights and what have you. It was almost expected, because you see that kind of stuff happen in a variety of films where you know, stuff gets kicked up on the lens for added effect. But
yeah, there's a scene in the Speed Racer movie that I worked on and
Like this movie where somebody was crawling out of a shallow grave.
Yeah, the Mach 5 goes over the side of a cliff and it is driving down the mountainside in an impossible maneuver. The shot just seemed absolutely ridiculous. And so I was just like, well, whatever. And I put some snow on the lens and they loved it and they wanted more snow. And I was just like, oh, well, that was not what I had intended by that, but sure. And so now there's a lot. But anyway, that's the kind of thing that happened.
Did you cause like Look Dev to go back and be like, hey, we're going to put this on all of the scenes now?
No, that did not happen. Although I imagine whoever did the different bokeh shapes with the convolve, they probably had that problem where they saw that in one shot and they're just like, we're doing that everywhere.
It's gorgeous.
Anyway, Speed Racer, bad movie. Don't watch it.
In terms of other weird lens stuff, there was that weird, they did it a couple times where it was pretty similar extreme close-ups of Leo, but I think it was mostly in some of his like dream or flashback sequences where they would like extra blur the edges of the frame. Did you see that?
Yeah,
it's hard to tell if that was a different lens choice, because I mean there are lenses that sort of simulate that, or if that was post done.
I think there is one where it's a super extreme close up on him and the background is like really, it not only is it out, but there's also a sort of a vignetting that's happening. And so I think that maybe that was a lens effect that happened in camera, but I'm not 100% sure, because it is very easy to do that sort of thing in post. It's just, you know, you can Barbara Walters anything you want to.
it's like a circular lens blur basically.
Yeah. It's easy peasy. It didn't bother me when that happened. The dream sequences in general just drove me up a wall. But anyway, so this first battle happens. They escape on the boat. There are arrows and things being thrown and people being shot and stabbed. And it is a very complex action maneuver here going on. Like all this stuff that had to be coordinated for this to happen, all of the CG arrows and knives and everything that had to be put in here with people being parts of people's bodies going missing from certain maneuvers. So it's
the copious rehearsal is understandable when you see scenes like this.
Yeah. And so while it didn't connect with me on a level, there's also one really distracting thing where I think they stitch two plates together as they come around a tree, the lens changes.
There's a couple of those.
Yeah. It really just like, because we come around the tree and then there's Leonardo DiCaprio, but it's not like the same as what it would be if that camera had just kept moving. So there are a few of those stitches that jump out. I'm sure there are many more that I didn't notice at all. So that's fine.
Clever wipes. They're big fans of clever wipes. Remember?
Yeah. Oh, you just do it with like power windows and some clever wipes, and then you got a movie. Anyway, that is of course one of the more frustrating aspects of this, is downplaying any effects work that has been involved. Although this year they are up for VFX Oscar nomination, and
do you want to weigh in on whether or not they deserve it?
I don't want to like rain on somebody's parade. They did a lot of really technically sophisticated work in this film, and there are many things that are under the category of invisible effects where you're never going to see what they did. So that I don't want to poop on that. But
I mean poop on it so much as rank it against the other contenders.
I don't want to do that either. Because whoever wins this year, you know, everyone works really hard on this stuff. And I think that there are a lot of really good nominations. We've talked about them, and that's part of the reason we saw The Revenant, was to see everything that's on the VFX Oscar nomination list this year. So we've seen Martian and Mad Max and Star Wars Force Awakens, and we've seen The Revenant. And so we just have Deus Ex Machina to cover. And then we will have visited all of them. Now, I don't want to rank them in terms of different things. Oddly enough, this is one of the few that don't have sand in them, but that's interesting. Domhnall Gleeson is in many films this past year, and several are up for Oscars, so that's interesting for him. Although that has no bearing on the visual effects work, but it was something that was kind of funny to notice out of the list of things that we're reviewing. But the thing is, it has more to do with like the poo-pooing on behalf of the director and the downplaying on behalf of the director of this sort of thing. Like last year, the Montreal company Rodeo FX was asked not to talk about what they did until after the film had won an Oscar, which is far too late for them to receive any recognition for the work that they did. But it is convenient enough for anyone else hoping to win an award that's not tainted by they used computers. So that was a little frustrating last year, and we spoke about that at length. And so this year, with something like this, where we're seeing, you know, all of this work that we can't even know fully the extent of what has been replaced or manipulated or spliced together from several performances, that at least this year they are up for an Oscar, and not like the previous year, because that would have been another disappointment.
Although one thing I will say about the visual effects in this particular movie is like, whether or not they really want to get into, you know, what was done and what wasn't done, I don't think any amount of visual effects would really take away from the stuff that they actually did. I mean, everything, you know, the cinematography, the acting, all that stuff is in addition to all of the visual effects work. So I don't understand why spilling the beans on the bear would make a difference to any of their Oscar chances.
Well, I think it's a little like telling everyone at the fancy restaurant, that the food isn't organic or something. Like you know, it's a popularity contest, and a lot of people have preconceived notions about what they think happens when computers are involved in things. And so you can sort of cater to that fear or have that fear yourself and not want to talk about the contributions in that it might downplay the artistry of something else. Like Chivo, Emmanuel Lubisky, the cinematographer. His first Oscar that he ever won was for cinematography on Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity. And that is a movie that is almost entirely inside of a computer. So that is interesting. And then he won another Oscar for Birdman. And that's a movie where the camera work that he did is intricate and complicated and could be praised, but it is impossible to have that movie without the visual effects work that stitches it together and makes the scene actually function as a full complete film. Like it is not conceivable that they could have done that in any other way. Even in the method where they talked about clever wipes in when they were doing their marketing last year. So, you know, maybe it is a fear that if they talk about using computers for these things, that then nobody will give them the other awards for stuff. It is unclear to me what possible motivation there could be for this. They also do. There was an unfortunate video circulating of after Leo won a Golden Globe for his acting performance. He's up behind the, basically after you win your award, you go back and you do like a little press thing in a room back there, and they ask questions and you hold the award and the director was standing there with Leo, and somebody had asked how they did the bear stuff. And he said he's not sure he's supposed to talk about that. The director did not interrupt him or say, go ahead. then Leo goes on to share an unfortunate story about how the director looked at hundreds of reference videos of bear attacks in order to figure out how to do the bear attack.
I'm not supposed to talk in great detail about how that was done because it was Alejandro and Chivo's very specific work. They watched over, Alejandro himself watched over 100 different bear attacks, but what he creates in that movie, in that sequence, is something that is almost like virtual reality. He almost awakens other senses, and I think people are talking about it for good reason. I think that sequence is going to go down in the history of cinema as an amazing, you know, visceral, tactile sort of sequence that makes people really feel like they're there. And yes, it was incredibly difficult to do, but you know, we rehearsed for weeks beforehand on just that sequence.
And as we'll very quickly get to, now that we have moved out of this first encampment up the river, abandoned the boat, and had some character tension, there is the bear scene, which is probably the most infamous part of this film. Whether or not someone had seen the film, the bear has been talked about quite a bit, mostly because there was, I think it was like Drudge or something, some horrible website reported this as the bear had raped Leonardo DiCaprio. That is not accurate, and it was really sort of, well, that's sad. But that has garnered it some press, and then also a lot of the critics who've seen it have said, oh, this is amazing, I don't know how they did it. And you know, after seeing it, I can say very firmly, it's absolutely 100% obvious that this is a computer-generated bear. It is a very good one. It is a very good bear. I'm not saying it's a bad bear, but it is definitely a bear that was animated by artists and rendered, and there's hair dynamics. The clumping that they got on the fur is amazing. That is very difficult to do, to have that look believable on a bear. And again, I'm going to reference... so did you ever see The Zookeeper, Dan?
No, I've seen small parts of it, I think.
Oh, it's, well, don't.
Is that the one with Kevin James?
Yeah, that's the one. And so there are all these talking animals, and they had a couple bears, and the bears would talk, and so they would replace the lower jaw or the top of the bear, even full face replacements and stuff. Like, I'm not spoiling anything. it's a bad movie, but they had to get the fur clumping just right, or else you couldn't blend into what the fur clumping on the bear is. And the bears that they would have on set have very, very complicated clumps of hair. Like, it's not just like a teddy bear where all of the hair just sticks out uniformly around it. So to see something like that here in The Revenant, where they've paid a lot of attention to clumping this hair dynamically, manipulating it so that it looks like it's moving around on a big, thick, wobbly animal. It's all good stuff. It's still, you know, it doesn't technically look like it is a real bear that is attacking him. It looks way better than the stuffy, though. I don't know if you noticed the stuffy.
No.
When they go to push the bear off of him, the fur clumping gets a little worse.
No, I didn't notice that at all. Yeah,
sometimes they have a stuffed animal on set. On some other movies that I've worked on, as a matter of fact, there is a dead wolf on top of a character in Lion Witch, and you know, sometimes you do a CG character replacement of that dead thing that's on top of them, if that might not maybe be super convincing otherwise, or look like the thing in the other scenes. So
like John Wick.
Yeah. Oh god, that stupid bear, dog. That didn't work.
Additionally, I agree. It was very good bear in this movie. I wasn't at all fooled by it. I mean, just like you, I suppose. But
I don't know if the average moviegoer would be completely fooled by this. But
I mean, aside from the fact that the thing I've said before, if you actually think they would let a real bear anywhere near DiCaprio, you're insane. Yeah. It's a good looking bear. But like, there are small bits of things that he does where it's like, well, clearly somebody just yanked his leg with a wire, and then there's a bear down there too. But one of the things I thought the attack was, it was brutal, it was long, because again it was shot in the one takes, and I think it actually worked here in terms of just adding to the drama of it all. But I was annoyed by the director when he made the choice to additionally sort of hit the audience with that sadness of, like, as soon as the bear dies, like the moment the bear dies, we have baby cubs in the distance sort of crying out for their mom. And it's like, come on, dude, do you really have to like try and tweak the emotional heartstrings every opportunity you get? Like, just let it go, man. Our character just got mauled by a bear.
There are a couple of people who kind of chuckled a little when the bear slid down the side of the hill and landed on top of him.
A lot of people went, whoa, like, oh man.
I chuckled too, because that was, I have to imagine it's not necessarily what he was going for, but there's just some sort of, it's like when Wile E. Coyote falls off the cliff and then the anvil goes off the cliff and lands on top of him. So it's a little
bear shaped anvil.
Yeah. It was just a little unfortunate that they chose to pursue that they needed to hit it that much harder. It's like he could have just slid down next to him. It would have been fine, because it's not like it was a central point that he couldn't move because there was a bear on top of him. He couldn't move because of the bear attack. If he was just laying there, it would have been the same. So it was just sort of an added thing that I'm not sure they needed to go for.
No, and if he wasn't under the bear, it would have been harder for the guys to find him, and it would have been more suspenseful, like, oh God, are they going to find his mutilated body in a bush somewhere because they need to get to him to help him?
It just could have been next to him. It would have been fine. It's just the added part of it being literally on top of him, that it slid down perfectly on top. That's the part that's just a little funny. But they find him, and they're all freaking out. And we have established that Domhnall Gleeson's father was a medic, and so he's capable of doing some things. So he does some like very coarse stitching of Leo. And this is actually one of the things about this movie that I wasn't really expecting, is that it is very gory in an unsettling way, because you are lingering on the gore, not necessarily the kind of gore that it is. Like, he was mauled by a bear, there's all these slashes and stuff. It's like, okay, but you're just like staring at it. It's just that's the part where it's just like, you just want to break eye contact with that sort of a thing. At least I do. Like, it doesn't engage me. It draws me out of, seeing the film. And I know it's to make me feel uncomfortable, obviously, but it is too uncomfortable. They hit that too hard. I don't know if you have the same feeling about the gore level, but it's just like not super necessary to dwell on it.
Some of it, yeah, like when it was all fresh and they were looking at some of it. It had the sort of that same, I don't know if you remember in Saving Private Ryan, where, who was it? Was it Giovanni Ribisi when he got shot and like the wound would not stop bleeding and they were trying to patch him up? It had a similar effect to that in terms of just being kind of gruesome. But, you know, again, at a certain point there was so much of it, it was just like, I get it. The throat part was a bit, disturbing, especially later when he decides to
shove the gunpowder
into his neck wound, which is like, all right, that's an interesting sort of mountain man technique for cauterizing a wound, but I wouldn't have gone there myself.
Yeah. So they have this exchange where, they question whether or not it's worth even saving him. And Domhnall Gleeson just can't bring himself to get rid of him because he's done so much for them. And they keep talking about this. And I have to kind of agree with Fitzgerald here.
If it wasn't for him, we'd all be dead because he knows how to walk through the forest to get back because they had to abandon the boat.
I mean, if they had stayed on the boat, clearly they would have died because those other people died. So he sort of saved their lives, but they don't know that because they don't know the fate of the people that are on the boat. I
wish they would have come across that, too, because in a movie where there's so little payoff for anything else, like it would have been nice for them to walk by and be like, well, there's a couple dead bodies on a burnt boat. Told you we should have got off the boat because, you know, he never even got that victory.
Yeah. Well, at least it would have reinforced the fact that there was some worth to Glass, some contribution that he was providing to the group. Because as Fitzgerald says, it was his job to make sure they didn't get, you know, attacked, basically. Like he was out in the woods and they got snuck up on and attacked. So he's not, at no point do I feel like the commitment from the captain, from Domhnall Gleeson's character to Glass, to Leonardo DiCaprio is ever really earned on screen. I feel like that if it had happened off screen, prior to the events of the film, because there is no clear bond between them. They don't even know that much about each other's past. They're not that necessarily friendly with one another, but he has an unwavering commitment, to seeing things through with Glass and to going above and beyond to make sure that he's fine, even though he's not going to go above and beyond for everyone. So it's very strange, especially the constant references to how he saved all of them. So I don't know.
Well, it's partially based on a true story, so that probably is one of those things that happened, maybe.
It's possible, but they could have actually had that in the film with something like a screenplay.
They didn't have nearly enough time in this 2.5 hours to explain why he was worth saving.
There's not enough writing in this movie to justify most of the things that happen. So I'm just going to flat out say that they could have at least justified some sort of relationship here. And then maybe that would have also gone on to giving Leo and Domhnall some acting to do.
Some things to say, maybe.
Yeah, it's very
How many
strange.
Lines did Leo actually have in this movie?
I'm not sure.
Like three pages?
But they have this... They have this whole thing here, and the Sun Hawk, we learn, can also speak English, at least well enough to object to his father being harmed and all of this other stuff happening. And prior to this, he had been speaking Pawnee, and that isn't clear why that switch happened or if it was part of some purposeful deception on Glass's part to protect his son. There's that confrontation with Fitzgerald and Hawk, where they go back and forth, and it's like, you know, don't talk and stay silent and stuff and be invisible and don't worry about it. So maybe that was part of it. But anyway, he talks and objects to them killing his father, and they, you know, stitch him up, and then they put him on the thing, and they're carrying him all over the place up to, I don't know, the mountains of Mordor or wherever they are. There's snow, and so they're like, hey, this is steep, it's probably not gonna work. And so Domhnall Gleeson decides to have some people stay behind, and they'll set up a little camp, and they'll send people back for them later once they get to the fort. And so they split up here. And it is a very tortured scene where Domhnall Gleeson's not sure what to do, but he decides that this is the best course of action. And for some ridiculous reason, he's like, Hawk, other guy, and Fitzgerald, you stay. And Fitzgerald, up until this point, had been campaigning so loudly about getting rid of Glass and his son. So it seems like such a bizarre thing. Like, it's just like totally random. It's just like, yeah, he seems fine, let's leave this guy here with him. There's no reason why he would possibly try to kill him early just in order to get back in time.
Well, I mean, there was a semblance of a justification, which I kind of liked that he basically went full bore into his mercenary character saying, like, look, man, we lost so many of our pelts that the only way for me to make any damn money on this is for me to take this ridiculous amount of money that you're offering for people to just sit around and wait for him to die and then bury him and then come back out. So, yeah, I'm up for it because all I care about is money and whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, as soon as he did that, you know, like, oh, he's just going to kill him.
And then get the money anyway.
I mean, the only question was, how many of the people was Fitzgerald going to kill? Was he going to kill Bridger and Hawk and Glass? Or is he just going to kill Glass and be like, well, he died in his sleep. We should go now.
Well, I mean, it did appear that was the plan he talked himself into. Mm. One of the things that I liked about the Fitzgerald character and Tom Hardy's performance of it is when he would talk himself into rationalizing doing something or having done something. It's like you're hearing him come up with reasons why this was the only proper thing to do. That there's no other way, that it had to be this way, that it's justified, that no one can question whether or not it was the right thing to do. So it works well, especially in that scene where he's by himself with Glass, and Glass can't talk, and so he makes up this decision that, oh yeah, just blink once for yes, and then I'll kill you. Not that human beings blink ever.
It was a protracted blink. He did it on purpose because he even convinced Glass that, like, look, man, you're not going to survive. You're weighing us down. Every minute we're out here, there's a chance that we're going to get attacked and killed. The appropriate thing to do would be to, you know, put you out of your misery now and let us get on with our lives. And you could see, while it was difficult for him, you could see that might be a thing where a father would sacrifice himself for his kid. And you know, that very quickly went wrong because the kid sees it and then freaks out, and then Tom Hardy stabs him.
Yeah. Well, and this is actually, but I think that he would have done it anyways, eventually. That this was a step probably in talking himself into doing this. But unfortunate direction where now Hawk is dead. His father survives a gruesome bear attack, but his son got stabbed with a knife in the lower abdomen and is dead now. I assume that's because he eventually bled out, but he goes limp real fast. I'm not an expert on abdomen stabbing, but it seemed like it was a very convenient and sudden way to do away with Hawk. And then off screen, Hawk is taken care of. But now he can't kill Glass too, because that would look suspicious. So instead, he has to make up some story about how the Ree are coming for them. And so this results in a sort of like panicked wake up attempt to disorient Bridger and to get him to agree to leave the camp as fast as possible, not take anything. Let's just go. And they do. And Bridger's very reluctant and confused about this and very conflicted about what they're doing, but realizes there's no way that they could stand up to, 20 Ree warriors that were coming down from the creek area. So he reluctantly leaves and leaves the water flask that he had been etching the spiral on with Leo, you know, just in case he gets thirsty. And so we come to realize that there definitely are no people down by the river who were coming to kill them. And Leo eventually works up enough adrenaline through grunting exercises in order to fling himself upright enough to get his feet untied and then crawl across the forest floor until he finds his son, and he falls asleep on him. So sad about the whole thing, and just completely destroyed by it. He has a weird dream He gets up and goes and gets some bone marrow from a bison skeleton that's off to the side somewhere that we had never seen before. But
yeah, just crawls over.
Yeah, and he gets some marrow. He's got that going. Get his strength up.
Basically every one of these scenes with him is like everything horrible has happened and he lays down ready to die and his body just won't die. So he's like, well, the only thing to do is get up and keep moving forward until the next horrible thing that puts me on the verge of death. But then I won't die anyway there. So,
well, he had previously only really been concerned about his son. And now that his son is gone, his major motivating factor is revenge. And this is, you know, your traditional Western revenge movie now, where he's going to go track down and find the man who did this to his boy. And, if, you know, it's what happens. It's what you got to do. It's, you know, the law of the frontier. And
speaking of that scene right after this where Bridger finally uses his brain for 5 seconds to realize that he was lied to, that is another one of the scenes that's just like clunky, clunky, clunky dialogue. Like, 12, a dozen, you said 20. Is it a dozen or 20? How would you even know? He's like, well, I wasn't counting. It's like, yeah, I think you were lying. I'm going to point a gun at you. And he's like, why were you at the creek anyway? I already brought all the water. It's like, water is the only reason he would be down at the creek. Maybe he was looking out for people because, like, that's something that needs to be done. Like, it's just one of those scenes where it's like, wait a minute, half of something doesn't add up. That means you're a bad guy and I'm going to point a gun at you. I immediately know what you did. It's like, come on, man. I did not enjoy that scene at all.
No, I didn't like that scene either because it was also very lazy in terms of Tom Hardy's character just like being so lackadaisical about the lie he had just told like 5 minutes ago.
And then he tries to kill him. He's like, oh, no, the gun's empty. He's like, next time you should make sure your gun's loaded. And then he puts two guns on his shoulder. It's like, if you're already ready to kill him because he's going against you, why don't you just shoot him with one of the other guns? Or like now that he's seen that you have just no issue with killing him, that he's gonna like fall in line and follow you. I don't think that's how that works.
Well, it does work that way.
Well, yeah, because that's the movie. But
no, but I think that his plan becomes intimidation into getting him to cooperate. I think that he realizes on some level that it would be incredibly suspicious if he is the only survivor that shows up and claims his reward. That would be very strange. Now,
he would have done the thing where like we got attacked by Indians and he would just like intentionally take like an arrow and stab it through his shoulder and break it off and then be like, see, look, I got shot with an arrow too, but I didn't die.
Or he would just kill Bridger and
bring him back and be like, hey, I brought his body all the way back, even though we got attacked by Indians and he died.
Yeah, or there was a weird. Okay, so he had a partial scalping scenario, and so he takes that very personally and makes that part of his mantra for living his life now, where he's going to go scalp other people.
I thought he did that to sort of cover his tracks.
What?
At the end of the. Did he say that, or are you just talking about at the end with the captain?
I was talking about the end of the captain, where he scalped the other guy.
Well, I thought he thought that the captain was out there by himself and he had to kill the captain. But if anyone were to stumble across his body, he wanted to make it look like it was somebody other than him that got him.
Oh, I didn't read that in to that. But that is the argument that I'm making now for a thing that he could have done to Bridger. So, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could have easily done that. I didn't think it was like a personal mantra, like they did it to me. No, I'm going to do it to other people.
At the end of the movie, I thought he was doing it because he just like completely lost it and was just like, I'm just going to do this to the captain. But yeah, you're right. It could have been the scenario that I was just describing where he was framing the guy.
I think he was just trying to weasel his way out of everything because whatever. But yeah, could have been one or the other. But oh, man, that last scene, that was not a surprise at all with the stick and the stuff.
No, that was so obvious. I was really frustrated. Anyway, let's skip ahead to that because not a lot's happening now. Now we have the French trader scene and they make the exchange for horses and ammunition and it's a really big deal and he needs to get his daughter back. Now at this point in the movie, we don't know that the French have his daughter.
Where were they hiding her? They're in the woods.
I don't know. Maybe they have her under a tent or something, or They keep her.
I don't think they had tents.
I have no idea. There were boxes and stuff. Who knows? Maybe they put her in a flour sack. I have no idea what their plan was, but apparently they had her this whole time, and they've been doing horrible things to her, which we will get to later. But here in this scene, they're arming the chief so that he can go after the American pelt guys who they think did it. Not actually the case, but that is what he thinks at this point in the film. Now, this scene was a little strange because we have an aha, but I can speak French moment. And the subtitles say in French above it. So it's just like, oh man, we've like double subtitled.
it was an aha for no particular reason. And this is the first scene of many where I noticed that a lot of the movie is ADR and a lot of it doesn't line up with people's mouths. Like
they were
just like hoping that people would be reading the subtitles and not look up at the person's face where their mouth was not moving.
I have to assume that's what it is, because the ADR is so obvious. And it's not that you know the language that they are speaking, so you can identify that the lips aren't moving with it. It's just that you know that sounds are happening when lips are not doing the things that they should be doing when those sounds are happening. So, like, it's really obvious. I thought that was just really frustrating. I don't know if they, like, gave them lines to read, because not the people weren't actually... I looked this up later because this also bothered me. There's apparently only 10 people who speak the Ree language, which is a variation of the Pawnee language, but it's not mutually intelligible. So supposedly, maybe they had him say something else completely. And the actor who plays the chief, I believe, is actually Navajo. So there would be no reason why he would know any of these things. I have to imagine this would have been difficult to hire a language coach to go with you on location for all of this and get the scene exactly right. So they might have decided, you know what, we'll just do it with ADR, and in post we'll have someone who can actually speak the language say all of these things.
Yeah, that would be my guess as to what happened too. But, you know, use some of that fancy computer technology to make his mouth move like it's supposed to move, because good Lord, was it distracting.
Well, it was very distracting.
It didn't help that they were like 6 inches from his face with the wide angle lens too. Like, good Lord, guys, like back away or something if you can't like actually shoot it.
Yeah, it was a poor choice, and it's not the only time that it happens in the film.
No, it happens many times.
Yeah, and so
even with just some of the Americans too, I think, right?
I'm not remembering anything that's sticking out to me. It was mainly this guy, the guy he comes across at the plains, and the another scene with the chief later, and it's weird. But they make this exchange. We go back to Leo, and he grunts and moves around and stuff some more, and eventually can limp enough to use a crutch for things. I'm just gonna kind of gloss over a lot of what he does, because it's just, you're just watching him crawl and grunt and make noises and barely move. So it doesn't make for good audio.
Yeah, he cauterizes a wound. He swims down a river. He eats some grass. He eats some fish. You know, the various survivory type things that one would do if they were out there. He makes some fires.
Yeah,
a couple fires.
An important fact: he gets the bear pelt that they have from the bear who harmed him.
It's nice that they took that as a memento to help keep him warm.
Yeah. And so he's got that. And like, there's that one really distracting shot where it was in that Variety, I think it was a Variety featurette that I know I've sent to you, you saw it too, where Alejandro's talking about the choices they made in what they were doing with it. Like, Leo's by a little bit of a rock outcropping thing next to the river, and the Ree are there, and they have Leo surrounded, and they've a guy up on top and a guy off to the side, and so the camera is just slowly moving around in between all of these things and back and forth and around in circles, and I didn't care for it. because it's so floaty and weird. It doesn't feel.
That was one of the ones where they spun around and they transitioned from a techno crane to a handheld shot in the like a wipe in the sky.
Yeah, and they have him go into the river, and then they swap the river that he's in because it was better to have the river in Montana for that. And then they go. Anyway, you should just watch the featurette. It'll be in the show notes for this episode. But that is just so weird to me. That scene, it doesn't have the like hair on the back of your neck ness to it that I think they really wanted to have, and maybe other viewers experienced that, but I felt so disconnected because I'm paying attention to what the camera is doing the whole entire time.
Yeah, I didn't find it particularly tense either. And again, some of it was, this is where, again, where they were talking about the claustrophobia of the wide angle lenses and right up in his face, and you're right up against this rock, so it feels like your face is up against the rock. But the nature of this wide angle lens means that like everyone else looks like they're really far away, and you can't see the emotion in these people. Like, yeah, you don't know if they're going to like see him and go like, oh, hey, this guy looks hurt, let's help him out, or if they have a look of anger on their face when they see him. We just are supposed to make the assumption that they're going to kill him because he's hiding. And then as soon as he starts floating down the river, we see arrows flying after him. So we go, oh, okay, I guess they're just going to immediately kill him. But yeah, I didn't find it particularly tense.
No. And they fired a bullet and went through the water. Never saw that before.
Was that a bullet or an arrow?
It was the water bubbles under the water. That was a bullet.
Yeah.
He goes over the little waterfall cataracts there down to another lower part of the river up to the plains. Has a little encampment at night. During the day, he witnesses some wolves attack and kill a bison. And he thinks to himself, man, that would be nice to have some bison meat.
After he ate his fish straight out of the water raw.
Yeah.
And that's another one of those moments where I'm looking at it, it's like, here's Leo with his endurance test. He's going to literally pull something out of the water where he's freezing cold and just start gnawing on it right in front of the camera. And it probably wasn't an actual fish or anything, but like, you know, those moments where it's like, it's raw and like, okay, well, give him something to do other than just like eat fish.
Yeah. This isn't Fear Factor, guys. So they have
Fear Factor Wild West.
Fear Factor Frontier Edition. You got to go for the alliteration, Dan.
Fear Factor Frontier Edition. You got to get that last edition to be an F.
Okay.
Hmm.
Well, what if it's just Fear Factor Frontier?
Fear Factor Frontier. I could do that.
Okay.
Triple F.
Is that permissible?
Triple F?
Yeah. That's how I feel about this movie.
So yeah, the bison and the wolves and stuff.
Yeah, and so he goes back down to his little thing, hoping that wolves will be more interested in the one bison they killed, which just turns out to be the case because he survives long enough to witness some fire and things at night. And apparently another guy all by himself has come upon the bison, scared away the wolves, and is just eating raw bison.
He had all that fire. You think he could have cooked some of it?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe he was hungry. You know, a little bison tartar,
as you do, bison tartar.
Yeah,
sure.
Tapeworms never killed anybody. So he's just eating his stuff, and they, Leo comes over and he's all like, please, I just want to have some bison. Please. I'll have these crappy fish. He doesn't say that, but he wheezes some words, and he realizes that the guy is Pawnee, and that he can communicate with him. So because, you know, Leo happens to know Pawnee. And so they have this discourse about what had happened to him and the bear assault and things. He gets a grudging little piece of meat from the guy, eats the meat and throws up because he hasn't, I assume, had anything that rich, or bloody in his mouth recently. And so they have a little thing overnight, and then the next morning it's like, hey, I'm gonna go now on my horse. Are you gonna get on my horse? You should get on my horse. Let's go. So be buddies. And it turns into like a little buddy cop thing where they're gonna just go around the West and like taste snowflakes.
that was such a weird scene. It's like, okay, we're kind of friends now. We're gonna lay under this tree, catch snowflakes on our tongue.
Yeah.
If you have, you know, if you're trying to illustrate the feeling of this Wild West kind of thing where there's nothing to do and all it is survival, and you find brief glimpses of enjoyment when you can, I guess that makes sense. But for a movie as self-indulgent as this already is, I found that just to be unnecessary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's nice in that no one's dying or being threatened or harmed, that they can have a moment to breathe. But it doesn't.
Like, shortly thereafter that, like, he has his little infection fever dream stuff, and then his pal gets hung by the French guys.
Yeah. And I don't like this dream, with the wandering through the mission and the
hugging the tree.
Hugging the tree. And the wife floating above him and all of that stuff. It feels dreamlike, but we're watching a movie, not a dream. So explain what the takeaway from this should be, I guess, other than it feels like these dreams are mainly like, hey, remember your wife? You liked your wife. She's dead now.
Yeah, you can see her again when you die. And your kid's dead too, so he's in the heavenly places at the church also. But at least there was flaming meteorite in the sky, just like in Birdman, completely out of context too.
I didn't mind. I was like, maybe we have some aliens coming, and this will get interesting. Cowboys versus aliens.
There weren't any jellyfish in this one, but at least there were meteorites.
Yeah. So anyway, he wakes up, breaks out of the little lodge. Walks, 30, 40 feet, finds the dead body of his friend with a sign on it, which is very unfortunate. And we come to realize that the French don't bother looking around their campsites very much for other campsites, because they totally missed where Leo was or where the guy could have possibly come from. So it's very strange. But they have that guy's horse. You can tell because it's all dotty, speckly. And there is an unfortunate scene here where, in order to have peril and tension and to have a Leo save someone that could come back to pay off later on in the film, they decide to go with a rape scene. I am not someone who feels like those are generally well executed most of the time. It feels like there is a guy writing a piece and he's like, oh man, what's the worst thing we could do? And then we can have him swoop in and save her. So I'm not super excited by what they chose to do here with this, where Toussaint, the French guy, is one of the trappers is raping her by a tree, and we unfortunately have to stare at her face and his face while this is happening, and the camera moves around the tree, and there's Leo, and he puts the gun to the guy's head. She gets the knife, he's like, okay, well, come on, let's get to the horse. And she's like, nope, I'm just gonna chop his balls off and then I'm gonna run. So she dispatches him and runs off. And then Leo, he runs off in the other direction on the horse. And it would have been nice if they got together and then they could have explained this whole wacky situation to the Ree together. But that didn't happen. And they go their separate ways. Leo rides off towards the fort. Tom Hardy and Bridger had gone through a devastated, what appears to be Pawnee town, and they weren't sure who did it necessarily. It could have been the French. I have no idea.
Don't forget, when he rides off, he shoots the gun in the other direction to confuse everyone. But the key important point, aside from the fact that this girl was there just so she could come back later, is he drops his little flask of water there, which...
Oh, yeah.
As soon as I saw they hit the dirt, it's like, well, they're going to find that again later.
Yeah, well, they did. And so this all comes back together. Chekhov's law of flasks and women that you save. And anyway, it's very neat and tidy, eventually. And so he goes off towards the fort. Tom Hardy and Bridger had gone through this village that had been devastated. We're not really clear the circumstances about why or what happened. It could have been the French.
Just a thing that happens at the time around there, apparently.
Yeah, it was the style of the time. So
to burn a village to the ground.
Yeah, and so they leave that. They go to the fort. They have a scene where Tom Hardy explains his version of events, and he intimidates by talking up what Bridger did. Because he can tell that Bridger's, like, not comfortable with the situation and is on the verge of just saying what had happened.
He's actively trying to interrupt, too.
Yeah. And so Domhnall Gleeson does not pick up on any of these weird vibes. He's like, sure, I'll go up to the safe and get the money. So he goes upstairs in a scene where I'm like, why are they focusing so much on him going up the stairs and walking across the floor and the sand falling from the floorboards? And I was like, oh, maybe they're going to go up to the safe later. But... that's only a possibility. And so anyway, he walks back down the stairs slowly again, and then hands on the cash. And in a weird turn of events, Bridger doesn't take his cash but leaves it on the table and runs out the door. But then when we cut back, there's no cash on the table. And I wasn't sure if that's a continuity error or if Domhnall Gleeson's character was totally fine with Tom Hardy swooping up the rest of it when he was collecting his cash.
Well, yeah, I had the same thought as well. The only thing I can conclude is that, you know, Tom Hardy said, yeah, we're partners now. We work together well. It's like, don't worry. He's really broken up about it, but I'll give him his cash, you know, once he calms down. So I think he just stuffed it in his jacket. He's like, yeah, I'll give it to him when he calms down. But come on, Domhnall. Like, as soon as you see him storm out and not take his cash, you should look back over Tom Hardy and go, what was that about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, doesn't he ask? And Tom Hardy's like, oh, he's just been so out of it. You know, he feels terrible about what's happened. Like,
yeah, but that's... Yeah. That didn't read that way.
Like, yeah, anyway, they say it, though, but... And they have the scene in the tavern later where Tom Hardy is trying to say that he is owed more money for the theoretical pelts that aren't there. And he tries to reason with Domhnall Gleeson about the thought process that got him to how he feels like he's owed more.
Sure, he did his job. He trapped him. It's not his fault that they had to leave him behind because there weren't enough guys to carry him, so you should pay me. And then, and again, some further clunky dialogue, Domhnall basically says, we're short $300 because you ordered more supplies than you were owed on this trip. And the fact that he said $300 when we know he got paid $300 for the glass thing was another thing where it's like, wait a minute, are you talking about that? Or are you talking about something else? Like, why did it have to be another $300? Could you have picked any other number when writing this to make it a little bit more clear what the hell you're talking about?
Well, I read it to be associated with the previous exchange. That's the only way I can interpret that, because the numbers are identical. But at the same time, then that raises a question about, like, would everyone have been screwed over, or is he just screwing Fitzgerald over because Fitzgerald is pressing him on money stuff? So it's not super clear. I think they could have done.
I took Domhnall on his word as to say, like, you know, everyone gets a ration while they're out there for months, and he took more than he was owed and just sort of tried to hide it. And that's why they, you know, they're $300 over on their budget because of him. So, you know, him saying he's owed anything, well, he should be lucky he gets paid at all when everyone else does, because he knows that he sort of, you know, indulged a little bit more than he was allowed. But it was, again, unclear and kind of clunky. So whatever.
Yeah. So they
more fake tension.
Yeah, and then Tom Hardy wanders out of the bar in a long scene where we need to see him fall in the snow. I don't know.
He's drunk. He's being stupid.
Yeah.
He's going to get caught. He's getting reckless with his banter and stupidity.
Yeah, and so they find the guy. And at first I was like, oh, finally Leo. And then I was like, nope, some other guy. And so they bring him in, and they're like not going to give him food or anything because food costs money.
It was the one surviving French guy because... All the other of them are dead, apparently.
Yeah, it was really unclear about that. And he's like, oh, all the stuff that had happened, and I was the only one that survived, and I got away. And I was just like, wait, what was the thing that happened? I'm assuming that the chief's daughter went back to him, was able to get back to him and explain the situation, and the French were destroyed by the Rhee, but that's not clearly spelled out. I don't recall a line of dialogue about that happening. And there's just sort of like a, he snuck up on us and he did all this stuff. And I was just like, Leo didn't kill everyone. Leo ran off on a horse. Would be impossible for Leo to kill everyone. It's like, did he stay behind and pick them off or what?
They did kind of blend those two things together with this guy who came in and killed, you know, stirred everything up. But yeah, the Rhee seemed pretty capable of finding the French whenever they needed to trade for things. So yeah, it's that's my assumption as well, as the daughter got back and then they came back and slaughtered everyone. And it just so happened that the only thing that this guy, like, he had just what was in his pockets that he was able to escape with in order to trade for some food. And that also happened to be the canteen that Leo dropped, because, you know, you see a nice canteen like that with a nice pattern on it, you don't just leave it there on the ground. You just pick it up, even if you're the head of your group just got castrated after he was being a horrible human being. So, you know, it's a free canteen.
Yeah. Whatever. So that's Domhnall Gleeson's big tip, that the guy something is up. This is also a big tip off for Tom Hardy, that he needs to get the F out of here. That very obviously this canteen should not have traveled as far to be with the French trapper guy.
Yeah. Well, it could have been Hawk. They said it could have been Hawk, because Tom Hardy has up until this point been able to convince Bridger that maybe Hawk just ran off or got captured or killed or something. Well, he's maybe not dead, but he's certainly out there somewhere. He's not like 20 feet away dead behind a tree that you didn't notice.
Yeah. And so that that it's very, very obvious Tom Hardy is getting out of Dodge here. And Domhnall Gleeson's very excited when they realize that someone is approaching, and it's might be theoretically someone that they would be interested in. So they go out and find him, and it's Leo, and they bring him in for medical attention, and Domhnall frantically searches the barracks and everywhere else, because he knows immediately after he sees Leo this is Fitzgerald that has done this.
Yeah, don't forget, the reason he's on foot is because he had his tauntaun moment with the horse, where he got
attacked
while he was sleeping by whoever that group of natives was, and he rode his horse off the cliff in that very nice CG shot where he bounced off the tree, and then I guess he was hurt and couldn't get anywhere to like get out of the snowstorm, and he couldn't start a fire because they would see him and come back for him. So he cut open the horse, removed the guts with a knife, and climbed on inside naked.
This scene did nothing for me. I know we're supposed to see the depths that he will go to stay alive, and that he will persevere through anything in order to get this revenge, but it's super gross.
And it is super gross. And there's a point where, I mean, the point you make that it's the things he's gone through just to get his revenge, to at a certain point, it just seems like these are the things, given the circumstances, that one would have to do to survive. It doesn't necessarily seem like they're entirely motivated by the revenge. It's just like, well, I'm not in the mood to die right now, so this is what I have to do to not die. I need to get inside this horse or whatever. But like, it's a combination of the brutal frontier environment that he just has to like survive the horrible, brutal day-to-day stuff. And then, yeah, of course, eventually he's on his way to get his revenge. But like, that sort of blurred line between this is just life versus this is my life because I want revenge. Like, you know, you're watching him do these things and you're like, that's pretty horrifying and brutal, but can't really relate, because I don't know why you're doing it other than just that's what you got to do to not die.
No. Well, see, this is the thing, though. I think that he would more than willingly give up at any point in this film if it wasn't about his revenge anymore. Because I don't think that he really wants to go on living under these conditions. I think that his revenge is the goal that keeps him alive and focused on doing this stuff rather than just giving up in the snow. So I feel like his vengeance is totally the motivating reason for why he does everything that he does to stay alive and not just totally bail on life and just sit in the snow like Jack. But what's super gross about this too is it just goes on forever, and it's like removing horse lungs one at a time, crawling in naked into the steaming horse cavity in the morning when there's like blood
horse cavity.
When there's blood slushy all over the fur, and he's like squeezing the fur of the underside of the horse as he's getting out, and you see the slushiness of it like going between his fingers.
It's that's just got
like,
some groans in the theater.
Yeah. That is something his character might have needed to do and endure, but as an audience member watching it, I'm not like, oh man, that's so amazing, like he's willing to do this to survive. I'm like, oh gross, ew gross, ew gross, ew gross, ew gross the whole entire time. And like I you know, maybe that is something to do with my weak constitution as a human being, but it felt like more like it was sort of exciting to the director to show us this gore rather than it was gore to have us feel a certain way. Does that make sense? Like he was happy to show us this thing, you know, like when somebody's like, oh, you have to smell this thing, it smells so gross. And you're just like, no, why would I do that? It's like, that's what some of this gore feels like. Sometimes it's like, you have to see this gore. It's just going to be like so over the top and so in your face and you're not going to believe it. And it's just like, but I don't want to. Like it doesn't do it for me.
And well, I personally am probably not the average moviegoer. I personally have the added problem of going, that's not a real horse. Those aren't real bear bite marks on him. None of this is real, except, I mean, he gets props for the fact that he got naked in a snowy environment, because that was probably thoroughly unpleasant. But other than that, it's like, yeah, of course, not real.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so he gets out of the horse. Sorry. There's that overhead crane shot looking down on the horse that spirals out, and we see the blood in the snow and stuff. You know, the little snow cone shot.
It was just like the end of 300, where they turn it into that sort of picturesque sort of Renaissance era painting.
Frustrating. When he gets to the fort and Domhnall Gleeson realizes what's up and like punches the bejesus out of Bridger, knocks him to the ground, and yells at him and has him like taken away as a prisoner. Threatens him at gunpoint first, taken away as a prisoner. And they have him search frantically for Fitzgerald, and he can't find him. And eventually he goes to his office, and he realizes the door to his office is open. Fitzgerald could have probably taken the time to close the door to the office. But anyway, he goes in there and he goes up to the safe, and somehow the safe is cracked. I'm not clear on what safe cracking abilities he has, but I'm assuming they're from his time down in Texas he referred to a couple of times in the film.
Well, it was a long time ago. It was like the 1800s, so they had fewer numbers on the dial, so you could guess them easier. I think.
It was just 1 and 0.
It was like 1 and 0. They had a binary. It was a 3-digit code. You had either a 1 or a 0, and you know it doesn't take a whole lot of time to go through those combinations.
No. And so he stole all the money. He stole all the money out of the safe. So there's the added thing here of like, it's not just that he was deceptive and injured somebody in the troop, especially since it was Glass, who he cares so much about. It's also that he has taken all of this cash that they need for the expedition, and that presumably he would get in trouble if somebody made off with this. And so they...
Good thing he recovers that later, and we sort of close that loop in the story.
Yeah.
Spoiler, we totally don't.
No. They make the decision that he's going to go off after him by himself. I don't know if he didn't meet Fitzgerald earlier in the film, but I would not go off by myself after anyone.
Well, he feels so personally responsible, and there are so few guys left at the fort that he's got to do it himself for some reason.
It just seems like it's a really good way to get yourself killed. And it is. But before that, he has a chat with Leonardo DiCaprio as he's being revived by some hot water and stuff and getting ready and having some soup or gruel or whatever that was. to reconstitute himself. And he's like, I'll be fine. I need to go get my revenge and I'll go get him. And like his
you
lips
gotta
are
have that, the line from the trailer, the I'm not afraid to die because I already did that. And you were just about to say his horrifying, disgusting fake lips.
Yeah, they're stuck together.
Yeah.
So anyway,
it's pretty gross.
Yeah. We have him barely wheeze those words out through those gross lips. And then they decide, okay, sure, fine. You come with me. You're not a liability at all, and you'll be able to track him. And he reasons that Tom Hardy is not actually going to try to make it to Texas, that he's actually going to try to hole up in the mountains somewhere. So that he figures he'll probably be safer that way or something. He rationalizes what he thinks that he's going to do, that he's scared and he thinks that he's going to run away.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because they find his horse trail in the snow because they set out just as quickly because, you know, can't wait too long or he'll have too far of a lead.
Well, it was the next day. They did it overnight. Transition thing where he slept. That's why he went from Leo, who couldn't walk or stand or do anything other than barely move, to Leo, who could ride a horse, track down a man, jump on him, get in a knife fight, etc. So, you know,
well, that gruel really gives your energy back after you haven't had any for a while.
Yeah, it's also like staying at a Holiday Inn Express, according to those commercials. So anyway, he's recharged for this. Curiously, the doctor was all like, oh, remember when there was that weird scene with the doctor and we don't see the doctor's face? They went out of their way not to show the doctor's face. I don't know what was up with that, but like, it's just like, he's going to be okay. He's like, oh, he'll be fine, you know, and then he like wanders off and then outside the window. And like right before you think you're going to see his face, Leo's head comes in the other side. And I'm just like, what is up with that? That is strange. But
can't say I noticed that particularly.
Oh, anyway, it was weird because I was just like, there's someone talking and there's no face. What is going on? Is this on purpose? And then I don't know, but whatever. So they get out of there. They track him. They find the trail. They go up into the hills covered in snow and trees and stuff. And they make a plan of how he smells smoke and they're going to come at him from two sides, which is always good when you have a party of two and you're going against one person. You should split your party up. And then you'll have an even better chance of not succeeding.
That's standard operating procedure for any Scooby-Doo episode, right? We split up.
Yeah. Oh, man. Wouldn't it have been funny if back at the fort they had run from like one door to another door and to another door and then like all chased after each other from one door and then the monster was ahead of them and they were behind it.
And then at the end he pulled Tom Hardy's face off and it was somebody else underneath.
That was Bridger all along. So anyway... No, that would have been ridiculous. Anyway, they have this thing where they think they got him, you think that Leo's going to happen upon him first, but he doesn't. Dom Hall does, he gets shot at, they have a little exchange, and they cut away, and that means you don't know who survived and who was shot, except this is a revenge movie where Leonardo DiCaprio has to get his revenge against the person who wronged him and killed his son. So obviously there is zero mystery about who has been shot. It is going to be Dom Hall Gleason's character. And we go back and Dom Hall Gleason's character is dead and he is freshly scalped. And this is when Leo decides he's going to drag the body for a little bit. And then he's like, oh, I got a really good idea. I'm going to take this big stick. And he puts him on, and you see him chop down the big stick. And so it's like, okay, well, he's doing something with that. And then when you see them riding and you see the one person on
the back
of the horse.
From a very far distance, yeah. Like, oh, he's on the horse and the dead body's on the other horse. And we're really far away, so we can't quite tell who's who. It's like, yeah, it's not him.
Yeah.
So when I saw that, I was like, okay, so either the he's going to be playing the dead guy or he put like something else up there to pretend to be a body and he's going to be hiding behind a rock somewhere. But no, he was on the horse. They weren't even inventive. They went with the first idea. Don't pretend to be the dead guy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how familiar they are with Weekend at Bernie's, but
not very.
That's basically what happens here. And I knew that on the back of the other horse, it was going to be Leo and that he was going to use this opportunity to shoot him, etc. So there was zero surprise as the events unfolded here.
Especially considering they waited so long to when they waited. Well, Leo waited until Tom Hardy literally like looked at the face of Dom Hall on the ground before he decided to pull out his gun and shoot. Like, maybe surprise him a little bit before he knows exactly what's going on, but no.
Yeah, I mean, he winged them good, but not good enough. And they have fights and stuff and then fall off of things. And then the CG knife comes into play.
you noticed that, didn't you?
Oh, my God. I have done a lot of CG knives on things in my time working on things, and I could immediately recognize it. I don't know if it's something that other people observe, but I see it immediately whenever I see that stuff, because I can see it where it doesn't exactly line up, and you see when they're wobbling it back and forth that the knife is jittering at a different position than the blade, the handle that they're holding, because the handle that the actor is holding is real. Yeah. And the reason why they do this is so that nobody gets accidentally stabbed on set. So there is no blade at all. And they add that digitally afterwards. And there's another one. One really bad one is when Leo puts his hand down on the ground with his fist balled up around the hilt of the knife. And the knife is flat to the snow, even though it wouldn't be, but I was just staring at that knife the whole entire time, and because we don't cut away either, you're tracking the knife the whole entire time. It must have been really hard for someone to do this. I don't want to demean the work that they put into it, but it was obvious what it was as the visual trick.
Yeah, I think that's one of those tricks that most people don't know as well as some of the other CG tricks. But I think there was a moment where the knife was like foreground and it went sort of down behind somebody where it was partially occluded by like a forearm, and it went down on the ground where it should have been like behind an arm, but it should have been like kind of poking out a little bit where you could still see it, but it was gone because they basically just like they were going to put in like 3 pixels of the knife, or they just basically said like, now we don't have to put it in over there because nobody will, they'll think it's hidden behind his arm. It's like, well, no, I can tell that there should be a knife over there, but there's not. And then it came back around. But that scene did have like the fingers with the axe was pretty out of nowhere, kind of brutal, where he cuts off Tom Hardy's fingers. But then later when Tom Hardy reciprocates into Leo's hand, which he's just sort of like leaving on the ground, dragging behind him for no reason, you're like, oh, he's going to stab him in the hand now, too. It's like, oh, there it is.
Yep. And they duke it out completely. And Leo's about to kill him, but then decides not to and just pushes him in the river.
Right, and he looks up and sees, it's hard to tell if he sees exactly who we realize is on the other side of the river, or he just sees some people over there who are watching him fight. And, you know, he mutters revenge is in the hands of God or whatever, and pushes him into the water. But I couldn't tell if from there he actually sees the daughter that the chief was looking for the whole time and say like, oh, she must have told him that. First of all, she must have recognized me because I was the one who saved her. She must have told them that I totally saved her. So like they'll help me out. So I'm just going to push him down the river and they'll take care of him for me.
But
since we never cut and everything's a wide angle lens, we have no idea who those people are over there. We're just assuming.
We also don't know that she got back with her father, or why they would be here. Geographically speaking, we don't know why they would be up in these lands by the fort, because that seems to be very far from where we were originally, which seems to be more around the area where they were living. So it's very confusing why they would be exactly in the spot right now with the chief and the daughter here at this moment. And there's no payoff in terms of the revenge for the chief and the daughter, because Tom Hardy's character had nothing to do with them other than just being another member of the expedition they were pursuing. So in order for them to decide to kill this guy, it has to either be a situation where they just like killing people all the time, or it has to be a situation where they recognize that this is someone that Leo doesn't like and they want to kill him for Leo. But that, like you said, it's not clear who it is exactly that is on the other side. And it does seem very unlikely that it is exactly the situation as it unfolds. It is a little deus ex machina there, where we have exactly the right people to kill the person there, who have no motivation really to kill the specific person, and who later on walk right past Leo because they don't care about him. They're not either to save him or to harm him. They leave him completely alone, and she winks at him, and they're off. And so here he is bleeding up in the hills all by himself. Very similar to earlier events for him. And we could wonder, like, is he going to make it? Is he going to, like, just give up on life now? Or is he going to go back and, like, see that everything's put straight? Is he going to give the cash back to the fortress people? Is he going to take Domhall's body back so he can be properly buried and have proper respect paid to him, because he apparently has a wife or something? I don't remember the specifics of that anecdote he was trying to tell Leo, but none of that stuff is really answered by this. Revenge is accomplished. Leo breaks the fourth wall and stares at the audience, and we cut to the credits.
Well, he sees his dead wife wandering around, floating sort of in the forest area there. So
he could be dead.
He's probably like, cool, going into the light now, but it's another ambiguous ending, just like Birdman, that we didn't necessarily need in this particular movie. But he's probably dead.
I'm unsatisfied with the ending to this film. As far as revenge goes, he didn't even personally take his revenge when it was right in his hands. And it can't be because we were supposed to like him more. He wasn't a likable character. So it would have been totally in line for him to have killed Tom Hardy. The other involvement of this element from the story, from earlier in the story, just it didn't connect with anything in the scene here. And the ambiguity over the ending doesn't elevate this to a level where you're like, oh wow, that's really deep. Like, is he still inside the dream world, or is he outside the dream world? Like, spin the dreidel, man.
Yeah, spin the top. I mean, he saved the daughter and the daughter's got his back, so he's a good person and stuff, and he's not actually going to take his revenge, because revenge is in the hands of God and it's not up to me to kill this guy or whatever. So, you know, I'm going to do my thing. But like, he'd already stabbed Tom Hardy in the stomach, and he'd already cut his fingers off, and he'd already come this far. And Tom Hardy probably would have died if he just let him lay there long enough. But,
not necessarily. Leo survived. It's a whole movie about this.
Sure. Well, you know, abdomen knife wounds are apparently lethal.
Well, it's just, I'm happy that we saw him die on screen so that we have some confirmation of that. But then the rest of it is just like, why then? Why here? Why now? Why stare at the audience?
No, I don't. I think that was a choice they made in production. Like, let's try one like this. And they went like, yeah, that's cool. I like that. Yeah, without any particular reason behind it. I don't know what the reason would be. But I mean, after all of this whole movie, getting back to like the whole catharsis of the thing, he gets to his revenge. We have this pretty sort of brutal one-on-one fight, which is, you know, we've got the fake knife and we've got the blatant choreography of getting stabbed in the hand and some stuff like that. But it's a good fight. But then, you know, nothing leading up to this led me to go, he's going to be the guy who goes, you know what, I'm above this. I'm not going to kill you.
I'm not going to kill you,
but I don't have to let you live or whatever.
No, none of that had been a thing at all.
There was no justification for letting him live at all.
Yeah, like there wasn't, you know, sometimes in movies they won't have the hero kill someone so that way the hero still is likable and not a murderer. This usually results in a string of movies where people fall off of things to their death, or are left to die amongst other little critters and animals and things that might be consuming them when they're outside of safety because of falling into a trap or whatever, you know. So there are all kinds of scenarios where they take the act of killing outside of the hands of the protagonist and put it in the hands of the filmmaker, so that way the audience can have the sense of justice being accomplished in that character dying, but also we can still like the person and he's not just a cold-blooded killer. In the case of this film, that's really out of character for the film and out of character for Leo, and it doesn't seem to mean anything in the context of what we had seen for the last 2.5 hours. So I very irritated by that.
Does it feel like justice was served at the end of this movie?
Revenge is a dish that's best served cold.
Like a snow cone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so final verdict. No. I don't like this movie. It doesn't make me like actively hate all of existence like Birdman does. But
I don't know why you keep saying that.
Well, I mean, that movie really just, I don't like it. But this one I don't like. I find it sort of annoying. And irritating, especially with the lobbying and stuff that happens outside of the film. But like, I could see why someone would appreciate this. Like, it's not completely unlikable. It's just I don't respond to this. It doesn't push the right buttons for me.
I feel similarly that this did not push the right buttons for me too. Want to watch it again or care about the characters or anything like that. The cinematography, there are some beautiful environment stuff in here, and I can really, really easily see and understand where somebody would go out in these sorts of environments and sort of fall in love with the beauty of nature and really want to capture that. And I think they did a good job of capturing a lot of that stuff, like especially some of the, like the large canyon areas in between the mountains. And then there's, you know, that, the CG avalanche later too, which is nice. But there's a lot of beautiful looking nature, which is kind of at odds with this sort of violent world they live into, but it's still very sort of reserved and uncaring. And you get a good look at that. And you get a good feeling of what it's like to be out in those environments. But that's not a reason to watch a 2.5 hour movie. And the characters and the dialogue and the motivations and the things that happen in this movie are just, they're not up to... They're not on par with what the movie pretends to be, which is this sort of deep emotional revenge story that has some sort of spiritual guidance along the way with these dreams and seeing the dead wife and all that stuff. Like it's not as deep as it would like to be. Although it is a beautiful looking movie, I can't justify watching a 2.5 hour movie just because it's pretty looking.
Yeah, and it's. Those beautiful vistas that we cut away to oftentimes as transitions between different scenes in the film.
The start and end of basically every scene.
Yeah, it's like, okay, the scene's over, time to show some mountains and some clouds and stuff and, you know, some time lapse or whatever. Like, there are very beautiful things they cut away to, but they're not part of the geography of the story. They're completely isolated. You could
like there's that argument up on the top of the mountain where we're sort of like looking down a waterfall at somebody, and we techno crane back up. We see our characters. They have the conversation. They walk away, and then the camera sort of moves and sort of like pushes into some water just because it was like a spot to put the camera to end on. It's like, what are you guys doing?
I just don't care for it. And so while it's beautiful, I just. I can't emotionally connect with it. It's like I'm watching Baraka.
Some of it reminded me of, I don't know if it still exists, but wasn't it on DirecTV? There was like a channel where you could tune in and watch like a sunrise from like a different place. You know what I mean?
They have those in like hotels and stuff.
Yeah, well, you could like watch the sunrise in Montana over like a nice lake, and it would be like in real time lined up with your sunrise. So you get this beautiful like morning wake up thing, but some of it felt like that, but then it was just like, yeah, it's gorgeous. And like you found all of these gorgeous like canyons and these waterfalls and these places. And while these are great locations to stage your scenes, I wish you would have done something more with the story. Like, sure, the long take camera stuff wore on me a little bit. I can see where it would be novel for other people and maybe they didn't hate it as much as I did. But well, I didn't hate it, but it just got old. But like, even then, like, you went through all this trouble to find these beautiful locations. You have this complicated blocking of characters and camera moves. And just the story and the dialogue is just clunky and uninteresting and not nothing new to it. There's nothing new to it.
Yeah. And they could repackage the film and sell it to Apple as aerial screensavers for the Apple TV.
They certainly could. I mean, at least a portion of the movie was shot in 6.5K and the other shot in 3.5K. So that'll work out well for your 4K Apple TV and stuff.
Yeah. In terms of appreciating the technical beauty of this too, I thought, you know, using the Alexa 65 here was an appropriate use, since their desire was to not use a lot of on-set lights to boost things, especially in late at night and early morning things that they wanted to capture. Chivo Emmanuel Lubitsky, I should just call him Chivo like he has nicknamed himself. But he has... there was that interview that he did, and he was talking about the reason why they decided to do this instead of film, make this transition away from doing the sort of thing with films, just that it didn't have the sensitivity, the light sensitivity that they needed to do this with. And I find that sort of frank honesty and assessment of whether or not you have the right tool for the job to be something to applaud, especially in the climate of bashing on people who use digital cameras for things. I didn't object to that at all, and I thought the low light stuff looked very nice.
I agree, although to a certain extent, you know, Birdman was digital, Gravity was digital, so it's not like he's really, you know, breaking new ground for him. And the Alexa is a great camera for this kind of stuff. It captures great imagery given the appropriate circumstances and when used judiciously. But I mean, you could do this on film just fine. I mean, the Alexa is like an 800 ISO camera. They got 800 ISO film. You'd be fine. But I mean, you know, they've got a lot of the deep focus stuff with the wide angle lenses. So they were not shooting even remotely close to wide open on these lenses, so they could see everyone all at the same time. So yeah, I guess they had a benefit there. I'm not entirely certain that they were using digital and pushing it as far as they may have claimed to be. But, you know, Tarantino just shot his on film out there, yeah, similar conditions. So
it's an interesting contrast. Another thing he had mentioned, another thing that Chivo had mentioned in the interview, was that they also wanted to do away with the grain. So they didn't even add on like fake grain onto the digital version of this. It's very clear and crisp with only whatever modest amount of sensor noise was available. So even though film can capture some things in low light conditions, it frequently has incredible grain for those low light situations. So that might have been undesirable for them. I don't know.
Mm. I think, and again, try not to be overly cynical, I think a lot of what they're saying is stuff that they just sort of decided about their decision after the fact. I mean, they were going to shoot this digital for any number of reasons that had to do with the conditions and just the environment, and it would be impractical to shoot on film, and it would just, you know, don't need to shoot on film anyway. So, you know, all of these other things are just explaining the benefits of digital, whether that would have been the choice or not.
Okay, well, whatever. It just confirms that you can shoot things on digital stuff. And
yeah, film's dumb and unnecessary.
Nice. Yes. So, anyway... eat that, Christopher Nolan.
I don't think he would want to eat that. It's film. It doesn't taste very good.
No. Well, that's why you want to have digital, and then you don't have to eat it. But I think summarizes basically everything I can think of that we wanted to talk about, except maybe like some of the, there's one really good review that I found that I feel like aligns very closely with my opinion, and I would say that they probably did a better job articulating this in the short amount of time it would take you to read it than we might have done in this past hour and a half. But that was Justin Chang's review in Variety of the film. It is a sort of beautiful dissection of some of the pomp and circumstance surrounding the construction of certain things and things that might have taken him out of it. So
yeah, it was a good review. I agree that it's pretty similar to our estimation of the film, and a lot of the criticism is similar. It's just, you know, there's a beautiful looking film, but there's not as much of an emphasis or a there's not as much craft in the storytelling as there is in the filmmaking. Anyway, just go read the Variety review. It'll be in the show notes. It's a good review. But
yep.
Any final thoughts before we dig a grave in the forest and bury this movie?
No. Hmm. Goodbye. I'm glad we didn't have to see it again, ever. So it's done. I did it.
Well, you're not gonna pre-order this one on iTunes?
Nope. I pre-ordered a Force Awakens on iTunes.
Okay. Yes, as you should. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I hear good things about it. Yeah. So you know, we'll see whether or not they get the VFX Oscar for this or any of the other Oscars they're up for. They're up for quite a few. But ta-da! That's us looking at it.
Yeah, for the Oscars, I think I'll probably get some cinematography nods again. But I'm actually gonna watch because I'm very interested to see what the Academy thinks of this movie.
It's such a crapshoot with them, so I have no idea. Because you also run into the situation where sometimes because people are voting on a ballot, they'll be like, oh well, I gave it to this thing for this one category, so now I feel guilty, and I'll give it to this other thing for this other category, and it's just like. Sometimes there are these sort of like consolation Oscars, and it's just like, oh great, like it wasn't like the best in whatever category it was in, but it got that because it didn't win some other category. Like sometimes that happens with Best Picture and Best Director fluctuations. So it's strange. I don't have a lot of faith in the process, but Todd Vaziri does, and he picked this as his winner. He feels so confidently in this that the Predictinator over at his site has predicted this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
We'll see, Todd. We're keeping our eyes on you, Todd. You and your predictions.
Late February? We gotta wait.
Yeah.
Behold my breath.
Well, good, because you'll fog up the lens.